Part 2, Chapter 1, Faith, Virtue, Knowledge. Whoever wishes to tread the path of renewal must be thoroughly acquainted with the prerequisites to this path, so that by fulfilling them, he may reach his goal. There are 7 conditions to the path. You will find them recorded at the beginning of the second letter of Peter, which reads, "Make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. For if these things are yours and abound, they keep you from being ineffective or unfruitful. Be the more zealous to confirm your call and election, for so there will be richly provided for you an entrance into the eternal kingdom of our Lord." Many have read these words through the course of the ages and have tried to put them into practice, without, however, achieving any positive result. They commenced by asking themselves what virtue really is. They talked it over, consulted literature, and studied all sorts of mystical life norms. After this preparation, they were able to compile a number of rules for living, partly purely biological, partly of an ethical, moral character. They set up commandments and determined what was and was not permitted. They outlined in theory the model of virtuous man and tried, each for themselves, to realize this theoretical image in practice. Then they were confronted with the task of attaining knowledge on the basis of the acquired virtue. They thought, "The gathering of knowledge consists of grasping intellectually, of training the brain capacity. One can most quickly do this when one is virtuous and diligent." Living extremely soberly and virtuously in their solitude, they plunged into study, into the achievement of the broadest possible intellectual understanding. They achieved a great deal, a very great deal. They knew everything that can be known in this world. They became highly learned. You will understand that thus, practicing virtue and amassing knowledge, they were also extremely self-controlled. If a happy laugh resounded anywhere, which by its joyful vibration can be so very infectious, the face of the candidate remained as unmoved as a mask. He remained in command of himself, aimed at his task of virtue, knowledge, and self-control. A ray of sunshine entered the study. A bird song pealed through the open window. Who would not from time to time cast a glance at the wide open fields? Not the candidate, certainly. He didn't want to be distracted. With iron steadfastness, with almost inconceivable endurance, the process he had started was continued. His face became pallid, his features sharp. No difference was made between day and night. Relaxation and bodily care were neglected. And did godliness come now? No, the candidate had to be godly. To all the exertion something was added, godliness had to be practiced. What was godliness? They consulted each other, they pondered it together, and established a program, a daily order. On the basis of virtue and knowledge, self-control and steadfastness, prayers had to be said, litanies muttered and pious meditations performed. In addition, prayers were never to cease, so those unending services in monastic chapels came into being, where one practiced godliness, kneeling for hours on tombstones in the cold of winter nights. So every monk candidate became a Christian yogi, for there was no real difference between the penances of these practitioners and those living under the blazing sun of India. Moments of exhaustion were inevitable, moments when, under the heavy pressure, thoughts strayed. This gave rise to great self-resentment, which again led to self-castigation. They beat themselves with rods, denied themselves what little comfort remained, and proceeded to fast, for the quality had to be achieved. They were not allowed to fall back, particularly because yet another task remained to be fulfilled. For the candidate was obliged to practice brotherly affection as well. What else could that mean but expressing himself in some kind of human activity. Preparation and distribution of food and clothes, taking care of the sick, kindness to everyone, and going about the streets with a sweet, exalted smile. For this too, time was allocated. How it was possible, nobody understood, but it was done. It is certain, however, that the candidate who had travelled this road was more dead than alive and virtually lived outside his body in a blood state akin to that of the perfect medium. And now the glory of glories would come through this brotherly affection, love. But at this point, the candidates found themselves totally out of their depths. They did understand that here it was not a matter of human love. They thought that they had to get mystically lost in love for Christ, for Jesus if it was a female candidate, for Mary if it was a monk, but a love for both occurred as well. Listen to them talk about their sweet Jesus and the radiating majesty of the Heavenly Virgin, and one night it happened. The prototypes of their adoration manifested themselves in the form of apparitions. They glided through the church windows. Figures released themselves from the stained glass windows and approached them, making gestures of blessing and speaking sublime words. You will have read how these pious people struggled to the finish along the path pointed out to them by Church Father Peter. And millions of people think that these pilgrims ultimately received admission to the kingdom of the Lord. What a delusion. The truth, the reality, is that these Christian yogis, by their method, forged such an enormous band with the reflection sphere that it became almost an eternal bond. The result they attained was that of mystic occult mediumship, the delusion of a dialectical salvation. The method of unholiness described can also be practiced in other ways. The same goal can be, and was, sought with minor differences. All this, however, leads irrevocably to the same result, a more intensive nailing to the wheel. Various mystical schools have experimented with this in all sorts of ways, and we can be certain that in the spiritual school of the modern Rosicross too, there are pupils who follow this unholy path because they do not sufficiently wish to listen to the directions, advice, and warnings communicated to them. Among us, too, there are those who cling to a certain ethical system, who embrace the philosophy intellectually with great yearning, demonstrating a great deal of self-control and steadfastness. They are godly in the sense described and dabble in brotherly affection and sublimeness in different forms. But this will avail them nothing. Their freedom will prove a delusion, their bond a leaden burden, and their salvation an entree into the land of shadows. And all this because they made not the least real effort to forge the key to the sevenfold path. The key to this path lies in faith. Make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue. You must have faith. In our modern times, this is a worn-out, burnt-out principle. By it is understood the acceptance or profession of a certain dogma, and one is said to believe in an orthodox manner, if such acceptance refers to austere Calvinist dogma or tolerant and liberal in the opposite case. And thus one is believing in various shades or, as the case may be, unbelieving. But the scriptures of all ages makes it clear to us that faith is not the profession or acceptance of a dogma of a church, a school or a god, but rather refers to the possession of something of which one must be wholly conscious. Such a possession must be experienced in the heart sanctuary, must dwell in the heart, or in other words, the permanent atom, the spirit spark atom, must be brought to life. Until this atom is awakened, there is no question of faith. There can be no question of faith. Everything, then, is only dialectical talk, imitation, natural religion. By contrast, we shall find that based on true faith, the seven conditions of which Peter speaks acquire a totally new, different, and at the same time a highly scientific meaning. When the permanent atom is impelled to activity, and the candidate entrusts himself to it in self-surrender, it means a new vitalization of the blood. Then something that radiates from every cell of our existence enters our being. And then there is an urge of the blood to virtue from within. This does not mean studying moral life norms, putting them rigidly into practice. Then one does not ask, what may I, what must I, or what can I do, but rather, our blood consciousness spontaneously directs us on the path lit by the light of the permanent atom, as if by the sun. Virtue here means directing oneself according to the light, following the directions of the inner light. If this light cannot yet be freed in the pupil, he is not yet in the possession of the virtue to go the path. Then misunderstandings and gross errors arise, and nobody is able to prevent them. Whoever experiences the salvation of the permanent atom in the blood, however, and thus directs himself on the path, also attains insight. You probably understand what is meant by this. Our brain centers have the capacity to grasp, rationally, morally, that upon which the senses are focused, and to retain an impression thereof in the brain. If the consciousness of a person is wholly of this dialectical order of nature and directed solely towards it, the sensory organs according with it, then it is absolutely impossible to gather knowledge in the brain of a nature other than that concerning the material sphere and the reflection sphere, if the permanent atom does not vibrate in your heart and you have therefore not been ignited by the divine spirit, you have not attained faith, therefore. And if you then read one of the books of the Rosicross, or attend a service, or even learn all the doctrines of the school by heart, you should not believe that you have any of the gnosis, knowledge of God. What then is the purpose of our literature? The aim of our literature is to focus your searching, to help you to attain faith, to guide you to self-liberating actions through which the permanent atom can be ignited. If these actions are lacking, then all your knowledge of our philosophy will be superficial knowledge. All your striving on this basis will be mystical occultism, and its result will be a fastening to the wheel. In this way, a blessing becomes a curse, and when you will have discovered the negative nature of your endeavors, you will, of course, not blame yourself for this failure, but rather the philosophy and the school. Angrily, you will take that literature from your bookshelves and bring it to a second-hand bookstore. Or if your anger is mixed with sarcasm and temper, you will return the books to us with a nasty letter, as has also happened. A third possibility is that you might develop an inclination to tamper with the contents of the school's literature and make it fit for your own use. On your bookshelves, there are probably various volumes of the scriptures from all ages. You can be certain that they have been tampered with, because in the past, many of those who considered themselves authorities on metaphysics thought they had to make alterations to them because the contents did not accord with their own experience. If you place a clean sheet of paper on the floor, you will discover that your cat or dog will sit down on it with its dirty paws. Nature always steps on the pure and spotless. Something radiates from things pure which attracts nature to them, but if nature touches them, they are soiled. And it always happens with the guileless panache of ignorance. One cannot be angry, it just causes pain. Have you ever examined in what a monstrous and terrible manner the Bible, which is already irreparably mutilated, is misused in this world? When the spirit spark atom in your heart commences its holy labor through your self-surrender and you attune yourself to that light, then, and only then, will there be knowledge in you in the sense of the scripture. You know that the spirit spark atom sets a new hormone free and thus influences your blood. As a result, a new torch is lit in the head sanctuary, the torch of the pineal gland. The light of this torch links the candidate with the gnosis, with it, with Tao, with that knowledge which is like a living fullness, a living vibrating reality. This knowledge is at the same time gnosis, spirit, God, light. It is all-encompassing, omnipresent. Of this knowledge it is said in the words 7th Psalm 139,
O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me, thou knowest when I sit down, and when I rise up, thou discernest my thoughts from afar. Thou searchest out my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou dost beset me behind and before, and layest thy hand upon me.
Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it.